Welcome everyone to today's Clouin Internet Seminar. My name is Jean Balance, and I'm coming to you from the EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division, where I will be helping to moderate today's Clouin Seminar. Today's seminar, The Use of Nanomaterials for Environmental Remediation at Hazardous Waste Sites, will look at the role of nanoinformatics in support of state agencies' health and safety oversight actions, and it's been sponsored by the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. Before we begin the official presentation, there are a couple of instructions and housekeeping items we're going to cover to make sure everyone's comfortable with how the seminar will actually function. So, if you have a copy of the presentation materials in front of you, I'm going to ask everyone to move from slide number 1 to slide number 2. If you haven't participated in the Clouin seminar before, these seminars function very similar to conference calls. The materials are open with each individual participant who will be verbally guided through the materials. So, as our presenters indicate to turn the page or what numbered slide to move to, you'll have to move through the materials locally on your own computer or print it out in front of you today. So for those of you who are just joining us now, we're on slide number 2 covering some basic housekeeping items. If you don't have a copy of the presentation materials, when you signed up for today's Clouin Internet Seminar, you would have been directed to the seminar homepage. On that homepage, you could find a complete description for today's session, as well as contact information for both myself and our presenter. And at the bottom of that page, there are links to download the presentation material as either a PowerPoint or PDF page. You could also pull the slides up in a web browser window by following the link on the left that says Go to Seminar. We're now, again, on slide number 2, covering some basic housekeeping items. The first reminder, as I indicated when we opened up our phone lines today, we would ask those of you who are participating by phone to please place your telephone on mute. You can use your own mute button or simply hit *6 to mute your line. We would ask that you don't place the call on hold. There can be commercials or background music that's playing that will be disruptive to the call. You are welcome to hang up and dial back in if you need to take another call. So just simply keep yourself muted and don't place the call on hold. And I thank everybody in advance for cooperating with that. When we get to the point for Q&A with our presenters, I'll remind everyone how to take themselves off of mute, so that you can ask a question or make a comment directly via the telephone lines. For those of you who are joining us via streaming simulcast or listening to the audio on your computer, you actually don't need to worry about any of those instructions, and you guys can simply listen along through your speakers or headphones. However, when it comes to Q&A for you, you will be using an electronic form that's available through the online version of the slides. For those of you that are looking at the slides in a web browser window, we'll find a series of numbered links that appear on the left, and you can jump through those to move through the materials. Again, we're on slide number 2. You can also use the icons and orange buttons located at the top of the slides. The single arrow to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow to the left will move you backwards one slide. You'll notice towards the white there's a question mark icon. As long as your pop-up blocker has been disabled, if you click on that, a new window will open up where you can actually type up your question or comment electronically and submit it to our queue. When we get to that break for Q&A, I'll read those questions out loud to our presenter so they can answer or address them. If you're having any technical difficulties with today's session, you can also use that question mark icon to report those problems. You just want to be sure to indicate a phone number where you can be reached so that our support staff can help contact you to troubleshoot the issue. The other reminder to point out, again, we're on slide number 2, is that today's session is being recorded. You will automatically receive an email from me as soon as that archive is available for free download and replay. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to produce the archive, and you'll be welcome to forward that email on to anyone that you think would find it valuable. If you really enjoyed today's seminars, you may be interested in our complete archive of Clouin Internet seminars that we've been delivering in this office since 1996. So I think there's about 440 archive sessions from the past 12 to 13 years available on that website. So those are the ends of the reminders that I have. Again, a great big thank you to everyone who has muted their phone lines. I'm going to move along to slide number 3, where I can introduce our speaker and begin our presentation. Again, today's seminar, which will look at the use of nanomaterials for environmental remediation of hazardous waste sites, will examine the role of nanoinformatics in support of state agencies' health and safety oversight actions. Basically, environmental remediation, which is based on nanomaterials, is no longer a theoretical concept, but a proven technology. More than 25 Superfund sites across the country are using nanomaterials for remediation, and the use of nanomaterials continues to present tremendous promise for technological advancements in other applications as well. Use of nanomaterials or engineered nanoparticles, or ENPs, could be more effective and cheaper than other conventional remediation practices or technologies. Despite the many benefits being presented by the ENPs, including their ability to decontaminate pollutants, many health and safety risks have been raised. For a responsible development of EMPs and to allow this technology to play a major role in sustaining a positive, healthy environment and vibrant economy, these concerns have to be addressed. So this presentation, which will be given by Dr. Efren Massawi of Southeastern Louisiana University, will provide EPA with detailed framework resulting from the inputs of various focus groups of experts designed to understand these information and technical needs relevant for environmental health and safety oversight at the state and local government levels. The framework includes seeking to understand from various experts, working with nanomaterials in the federal government agencies like EPA and their consultants, their opinion regarding the minimum amount and type of information and regulatory guidance documents needed for sustainable oversight of nanomaterials at the local level. Also, the preliminary results of a survey conducted with its state agencies and programs across the country to assess information and technological needs will be highlighted. So at this point, again, on slide number 3, I'm going to turn things over to Dr. Efren Massawi, who is an assistant professor in the Occupational and Environmental Health Department at the Southeastern Louisiana University's ABET-accredited OSHE program. Dr. Massawi?
Well, thank you very much, Jim.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, good morning, everyone, depending on where you are. And my presentation is going to be the use of engineered nanoparticles for environmental remediation of hazardous waste and the Superfund sites, and looking at the role of nanoinformatics in support of state agencies and health and safety oversight actions. I'm going to start my presentation in defining what nanoinformatics is, and what nano-enhanced remediation is, and then I'll go through that and present the outcomes of the framework that we developed with focus groups, and then eventually I'll touch on a little bit about what has been done and what is being done at the federal level as well as at the state level. So I'm going to go to slide number 4, and this slide is going to define what nano-remediation or nano-enhanced remediation is. Nanoremediation is defined as a method or technique that employs nanomaterials or engineered nanoparticles to decontaminate or detoxify contaminants. And that's essentially the main reason is to reinstate the land or ecosystem to its original state. Imagine some sites that may have DDT. Imagine some sites that may have aldrene or dalgrine, chlordane, PCBs, or tetrachloroethylene, which are all persistent and bioaccumulative. It may take quite some time to decontaminate these using our traditional method. So we're going to look at how nanotechnology has been employed and how effective it can be and how it can reduce the time and what are the issues or information that is needed at least to support the action of remediation and at the same time protect employees that are handling nanomaterials. Imagine again living in the next to the hazardous materials. You want this site to be remediated as quickly as possible. So taking a little bit longer is affecting the communities that are living in and around the site. So slide number 5, it talks a little bit about some of the nanomaterials that have proved to be effective in the remediation. Titanium dioxide, for example, has been used very much in remediating some complex hazardous materials. Silver, iron, and other materials like zirconium oxide have all been used to decontaminate some sites. At least at the pilot scale or at the laboratory scale, these materials have proved to be very effective. Slide number 6, if you move to slide number 6, some specific applications of nanomaterials for environmental remediation. Look at the remediation uses for bimetallic nanoparticles or zero valent ions. You see that water, groundwater, sediments, surface soil, or soils have been decontaminated with hydrocarbons. Some titanium dioxide as well has been used. Engineered nanosilver has been used for that particular purpose as well. If you look at multi-carbon nanotubes, multi-walled carbon nanotubes, they have been used very much to decontaminate heavy metals that would otherwise get into drinking water and affect communities or public health issues. has been used to decontaminate sites that have had underground storage tanks, for example, sorption of VTEX compound, butene, toluene, xylene, and related substances. Nano-zero-valent clays and zeolites have been used for ion exchange of heavy metals as well. And carbon-based dendrimers have been used for decontamination of polyaromatic hydrocarbons. If we move to slide number 7, most of you probably have heard this definition before. If not, then according to the American Society of Testing Materials, they define nanoparticles as a very minute particles of 10 to the power of minus 9 meters. That is a measure of, let's say, much less than the thickness of hair. At least this definition includes compounds that have 2 to 3 dimensions measuring 1 to 100 nanometers. We may also have some materials that go to up to 300 nanometers, but that goes a little bit to microscale, and so that will be excluded from this definition. At this scale, nanomaterials, or engineering nanoparticles, possess some properties that include surface areas. And so, as it possesses this area, their reactivity is kind of increased. And some other novel properties that are very distinct and can be very useful for remediation is the chemical, physical, and biological properties. And these are very much distinct from the bulk particles of similar chemical composition. Imagine being a chemical engineer and then you design bulk particles of similar characteristics to nanoparticles, and then nanoparticles behave differently with all these parameters than the conventional particles. And at this level, this is what usually makes them valuable in the treatment of hazardous materials. Figure to slide number 8, you see some types of nanomaterials. You can have some anthropogenic or engineered nanoparticles of all these categories. You can also have incidental particles. That comes from combustion processes, industrial processes, vehicle emissions, construction, and so on and so forth. And yet you can have a third particles from plants, trees, oceanic sources, and the other water bodies, or dust even. But at least the anthropogenic are different from the rest of these other two categories because they are designed, they are synthesized in the lab. They are synthesized in some laboratory scale for a particular function. So nanoparticles are designed with a functionality in mind. So for environmental remediation, they will design this to attack some complex organic materials that will otherwise be decontaminated by traditional methods for a long period of time. So we'll see how these kind of processes help kind of decontaminate hazardous waste. So why did we have this project? This project was conceived because it was realized that EPA has been working with nanomaterials for quite some time now on the Superfund site. Superfund sites are, for those of you who are not familiar with the terminology, these are sites that are under the CERCLA legislation in the United States that came up in 1980s to address issues related to Superfund sites. Whether the person who contaminated the site is unknown or is known, but the regulation requires that this site be decontaminated, and then the person who contaminated the site can then be asked to compensate the federal government, or if the state agency that is concerned with the decontamination, then they can be reimbursed from the Superfund that was created at that time. Some of these hazardous waste substances deposited in the Superfund sites are persistent, like I said. They are bioaccumulative, and they're toxic. Being persistent means it can last for a long time. It's kind of hard for conventional processes to kind of decontaminate in a timely manner for the site to be reused or put in another different use. They are toxic because once these substances get into our health systems, sometimes they can impact on children, workers working on the Superfund sites, or even communities in and around the sites. We have noted that EPA is doing this because they think traditional methods are very costly, and they will take quite some time to revamp or rehabilitate the site. So nano-enhanced remediation, like I defined, is very fast and cost-effective and very promising technique of conducting cleanup operations in a thousand and thousands of sites that we have in our country. Slide number 10 talks about what is the site. What are these sites? Superfund sites is an uncontrolled or abandoned place where hazardous materials would be located. Contaminants from the sites can affect remediation workers, can affect neighboring communities, can affect the general public as well as the environment. So, like I said, implementation of this program or Superfund remediation program was implemented under Comprehensive Environmental Response and Contamination Liability Act of 1980s. Nearly 1,200 Superfund sites require immediate cleanup. And this is just a tip of ice, because we have so many sites under other programs that also require remediation. And so if the nanomaterial technology proves to be efficient, cost-effective, then they can be, by extension, be used in other sites as well. If we go to site number 11, we'll see all these sites that are high risk and part of a larger problem in our country. For example, sites that are on the national priority list, meaning they need to be cleaned on immediate basis, compose almost close to 1%. That's about 750 sites across the country. Other Superfund sites that were not on the NPL are making 1,200. Is about 500 of them. States and private companies, they own sites that also require cleanup, and they are almost 150,000. Some sites that are in the civilian agency's dominion are almost 3,000 of them. Department of Energy, Department of Defense, both of them have sites that total about 12,000. And then some other sites that are associated with USTs or underground storage tanks, they are contaminated and they require cleanup. These are almost 125,000. And those sites which are under Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, all of them are about close to 4,000, and they all make about 300,000 sites across the country. It's a big problem. And you can see that the Superfund sites, it's part of a larger problem as such. And so if nanomaterials can be used, and they're useful, and they're found to be cost-effective, it's going to help us a lot to decontaminate all these sites. And considering that the sites can make a couple of acres, probably a lot of land is going to be available for other users as well. Slide number 12. We go to some chemistry or processes governing nano-enhanced environmental remediation. Titanium dioxide, which I mentioned as one of the materials that have been experimented in the pilot scale, they're based on photocatalysis in target compounds or organic pollutants. Some nano-zero-valent iron or iron oxides, dendrimers, they are based on adsorption techniques. And nano-zero-valent iron, which is famously used for halogenetic organic compounds, these are based on redox reaction or reduction oxidation reactions. And like I said, at the scale of nanomaterials, the materials have a very large surface area, making them very potential candidates for increased reactivity. And so redox reactions are predominantly used for this purpose. Look at the chemistry of nano-remediation of TCEs, tetrachloroethane, with nano-zero-valent iron. So the surface areas are very large, or increased, highly increased. If they dope you with probably palladium or copper and other chemicals, and also probably improved with some pigments, vegetable oil pigments, for example, they are very effective in decontaminating some surface, some organic pollutants. Here now I'm going to present to you the chemistry of that. You see the iron at this level, at the scale of that. You will see the iron zero valent there, and then you see electron. Electron is denoted to the complex tetrachloroethylene, which is persistent and bioaccumulative. It will not otherwise decontaminate if you didn't reduce it to ethene, which is C2H6 plus chlorides. Chlorides, of course, are dissolved. They get into the waterways. And if ethene or C2H6 is kind of released as gaseous pollutants. And, of course, you have iron 2 oxidated to iron 2. And then, of course, that's kind of like rusting iron and so on and so forth. And so you see that nanozero valent iron redox potential makes them 25 to 30 times faster than otherwise would have been for the case of bulk iron. If we go to slide number 14, so the reaction rate is very high. The efficiency is kind of improved depending on the kind of catalysis in, that you may use, or dopings that you may use. So you see the remediation technology, for example, the traditional conventional remediation technology that is based on pump and treat without nano-enhancement can cost up to $5 million per site. If you do traditional remediation methods using bulk ions to form permeable reactive barriers, for example, the cost a little bit is lowered to $3.4 million per site. But if you use nanozero valent iron, that cost is reduced tremendously down to $600,000 per site. So you see that just looking at the cost comparison of these technologies, nanotechnology seems to work a little bit as cost-effective in comparison to the conventional remediation technologies. So traditional, you can conclude that traditional remediation methods or technology are highly costly. And because the reaction rate of bulk iron or other bulk materials that are used for this purpose are slower, the time it may take to clean up the sites to put them in productive use across the United States can be as much as or as many as 40 years. To clean all the sites up to the acceptable standards and levels for productive use. So on the economic incentives itself just tells us that it's worthwhile going for nanotechnologies. So what is nanotechnology, nanoinformatics, and so on and so forth? What is understood now in the environmental health and safety community is that nanomaterials or engineered nanoparticles can pose environmental risk. They can pose health risk, and they can pose safety risk as well. I'll discuss those as we go through this lecture today. But nanoinformatics background, we thought because of nanomaterials will pose environmental health and safety impacts, but they are kind of useful in supporting environmental remediation quickly and cost effectively, there is need to look at the negative side of this before we put the practice into full-fledged type of operations. Because we don't want to repeat the same mistake that we did, for example, with DDT in the past, or PCBs, that kind of materials that emerged to be very successful in remediating, for example, malaria for the case of DDT, or working as insulators for the case of PCBs. But eventually, after 10 years down the line, or 12, 15 years, 20 years down the line, these materials were found out to be very, very toxic. And up to this moment, we are regretting that we had to allow these materials to get into the system because they are still bioaccumulative. They are found in fish, they are found in other ecosystems, and they are creating a lot of illnesses that it costs us a lot of money to address. So, like I say, nanomaterials and nanotechnology have now reached an advanced stage of commercialization for various applications across all consumer uses, including sunscreens, including paint pigments, and many others. EPA has already proven that this technology is successful at pilot scale and lab scale as well. So it's up to us to determine on how, to what scale do we want to expand to. But exposure to engineered nanoparticles have the potential to cause significant ecological and safety impacts. A lot of data now is documented that they can cause neurological impacts, they can cause a lot of respiratory problems. They are also a safety hazard. So scientific community is now concerned about these issues and how to handle the materials most effectively. At the lab scale right now, a lot of engineering controls are put in place. A lot of training is ongoing, a lot of bulletins are coming up to how to handle the materials so well that at least human beings are not affected at the cost of the beneficial aspects of these materials. If we go to slide number 16. Like I said, past examples of DDT or PCBs were confirmed to be deadly. And we are not going to accept this precedent for nanomaterials. Let's work together and try to address the issues coherently so that when these nanomaterials are used on a large scale, they don't pose the similar experiences that we have had for these two materials. Since nanomaterials in the workplace in particular and in the environment in particular remains largely unregulated, and you see through my slides that we still don't have regulations at the local level or at the state level, not even at the federal level. We don't have regulations that are kind of legislated or even executive orders or even to regulate these materials so far. So a precautionary approach based on information that is currently available is kind of like prudent, and we need to probably promote that. However, a precautionary approach that is based on voluntary approaches can be really hard to enforce or to probably implement based on the cost effectiveness and other technological capability of those who are implementing a precautionary approach. So a nano-specific environmental health and safety oversight mechanism then would be prudent to account for the unique characteristics of nanomaterials that they describe. But they keep on changing. When you're using them in the environment, if they kind of are exposed, their characteristics change. And if their characteristics change, and so their environmental health and safety aspect as well. So how do we regulate these materials? What kind of regulatory framework are we going to propose, either to the federal level, state level, or local level for that matter? And so it's kind of only these changes that are appearing to be particularly prevalent with nanomaterials are kind of making us or making the professional community difficulty. It's kind of creating difficulties in proposing metrics and type of a system, a coherent system that will be used as a framework to develop either regulatory standards or non-regulatory standards. So nanoinformatics objective is kind of coming up with that information that will be very useful to begin with at the local level, because the state and the local counties are the ones who are much more closer to the Superfund sites and who kind of charged with the oversight either of the workers and the communities in and around the Superfund site. Slide number 17, I'm going to define what nanoinformatics is. Nanoinformatics is kind of a technique or a technology or a procedure of collecting and collecting information in technological type of aspects relevant to nanomaterials to enhance the capability of the state, local levels, or programs, or federal agency to anticipate, recognize, evaluate, control, and then confirm that the controls are working, to anticipate potential hazards, to recognize potential hazards, to evaluate and control these potential hazards associated with nanomaterials, and to confirm that the controls that we have put in place are indeed working. And this, it's all across all applications of nanomaterial, be it synthesis in the lab, transportation across interstate, or even environmental remediation of Superfund sites. So this is the framework under which this project has been conceived and been implemented. Slide number 18 gives us what NIOSH, National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, produced in 2010, related to information related to nanomaterials that need to be considered. For those of you who want to know more about that, you can look at the report that was produced by NIOSH on progress towards safe nanotechnology in the workplace. I consider myself a Superfund site to be a workplace where contractors who are doing remediation are kind of working towards cleaning the site. They might come there, a contractor with his employees, or her employees, for that matter. Maybe they can be 10, 15, 20 employees. And so following this framework of NIOSH, I thought we can work it very well to develop the information that is needed for this particular activity, that is for state and local agencies use for their oversight actions. NIOSH says hazard identification. Is there a reason to believe that nanomaterials could be harmful? Yes, science has shown that. Nanomaterials are harmful. Toxicological research has shown that. Health effect assessment on animals, and then rats and other related animals have shown that these nanomaterials can be harmful. So we need to be protective. We need to be very precautionary in handling the materials. Safety research has also shown that these nanomaterials can probably ignite at the nanoscale. They are very powdery. And so the ignition level it can ignite and cause a safety hazard. How do you characterize hazards? How and under what condition could this material be harmful? So look at the materials, how these materials are handled in the Superfund site. Not only in the Superfund site, because the contractor would need these materials from the vendors. The vendor will ship the materials across the interstates to the site. And then the site will use the materials, and there will be some kind of post-treatment or post-remediation hazardous waste, or waste for that matter, that will need to be handled with care. So how do we characterize this? What information do we need to characterize all this life cycle type of approach of nanomaterials? And then you have exposure assessment. I'm an industrial hygienist, and so we sometimes do exposure assessment. You can do a prospective exposure assessment or retrospective exposure assessment. And so, is there an exposure in the real world conditions? Is there field assessment being done? If it's been done, how is it being done? Do we have information that we can have it accessible to the state agencies so that state agencies are aware of that type of field assessment? Do we have some kind of control technology research that has been done? What type of personal protective equipment contractors and his employee or employee are using? And then, of course, we have risk characterization. Is substance hazardous and will there be exposure? If we have that relationship, then can we do some dose modeling in the absence of instrumentation? And if you can do that, can that information be useful for the state agencies so that they can take actions? And then, of course, you come up with risk assessment, risk management. Once you have gone through all this, then you come with risk management. How do you communicate the risk? How do states communicate that risk to communities, to workers? How do states develop guidance documents for each of their state superfund sites or for their superfund sites in the region or in the state? How is this information to be disseminated? So based on this NIOSH framework, we came up with a framework, a hypothesis, slide number 19. We came up with a hypothesis saying, what is information that exists for traditional remediation technologies? Is the existing information sufficient for local levels? Or would there be needed a new information for traditional remediation? For purposes, of course, of oversight by the state and local levels. With nano-enhanced remediation, similar questions, two questions. Do we have existing information right now? Is that information sufficient? And if that information is not sufficient, do we need new information? Do we need some scientific knowledge in addition to what is existing now? Or do we need some technological knowledge that the states may need just to perform their functions, if they need to perform functions? And so we expect that once you've done this, all this in surveys that we've done, that we can come up with a compendium of information relevant to not only to the state agencies per se, but to various professions working with nanomaterials at the state level, at the local level, including industrial hygienists, chemical engineers, including laboratory scales, including vendors, that if that information can be used, including emergency preparedness, of course. And so this hypothesis was used to sit down with some focus group that, slide number 20, that their discussion yielded this type of a framework. And they say, this is a framework that we can use based on the NIOSH framework on identifying, characterizing and risk management, the slide that I just described on slide number 18. Then, on slide number 20, we can come up with this kind of a framework. We can synthesize all that information into one type of a framework to understand the information need for regulatory and oversight actions, particularly safety and health and environment, of course, during nano remediation. So we say that, what are the site characteristics? EPA, if you go on the website, on the EPA website, on the third Superfund site, you'll see a lot of information on each of the Superfund sites across the country. So that information will be available. Hazardous waste characterization, to some extent, that information will be available, and you can generate that if it's not available to support the actions. Do you have monitoring surveillance? Just like if you can recall that many states across the country have blood level registries for children. And across the country, since we banned lead use in paints, in gasoline in 1978, there has been monitoring with lead, LEAD, I'm sorry for the accent, blood lead levels have been monitored. Do we have the same monitoring scheme? Can we put up a scheme for monitoring and surveillance so we can conduct epidemiological studies so that Department of Public Health in various states can have kind of epidemiological studies conducted, and that information can be available to other stakeholders as well? Product liability insurance. We might need information related to insurance, liability, and so on and so forth, because these materials, we have said, they're toxic. What is the liability on the part of contractors? What's the liability on the part of the states that are contracting or giving contracts to these contractors? Do we need insurance or schemes for the workers, and so on and so forth? Are there any ethical issues pertaining to the use of nanomaterials at the local level? If you are remediating the land, and then the nanomaterials kind of reach out to groundwater, and they happen to manifest into a more potent or more toxic substances, is that ethical? It's probably not. And so do we need information on that? Do we have enough information at the lab scale that will be available to the state agencies about the toxicity, environmental, ecological, and safety aspects of these materials, so that that information can be available to different states and programs for use, just in case we have spillages, for example, on the highways. So how could local agencies respond to the spillages? We know across the country we have material safety data sheets that go along with the trucks, for example, that are carrying chemicals. And those material safety data sheets can be accessed by the local levels when they are responding to emergencies, spillages of chemicals, for example. In the case of nanomaterials, because they have different chemical and physical characteristics from the bulk materials, the material safety data sheets for the bulk materials cannot be used for the similar materials at the nano level, for example. And so what do state agencies, emergency responders, will need in that scenario in case of spillages? And then, we go to risk assessment. What are the work practices? How do workers in the Superfund sites conduct themselves on handling these materials? In industrial hygiene, we mentioned job tasks. What are the tasks that the workers go through in preparing to inject the nanomaterials into the ground? So those tasks could be exposure scenarios. And of course, when the materials become airborne, if they have potential to become airborne and go beyond the boundaries of the site, they become a public hazard. And so it's also, if they have the potential to become airborne, it's also a potential source for exposure scenario to the general public. And of course, understanding the route of exposures, that means the inhalation processes, the skin, or even ingestion, in case of accidental ingestion, for example. Do you have enough environmental, health, and safety practitioners knowledgeable about these materials? Like I said, I'm a chemical engineer who has come to work with nanomaterials, but the characteristics are so much different. Even a chemical engineer like myself, it's kind of hard to conceptualize their novel properties at the level of nanoscale. They change completely from the bulk material that you are known to use and design processes for. So do we have enough EHS practitioners who know a lot more about these nanomaterials that we can deploy to the state agencies just to conduct some training and on exposure and risk assessment? Do communities and consumers have the right to know? Do they have the knowledge that these nanomaterials do exist? Do we have some hazards, anticipate, recognize, evaluate, control, and confirm methods in place just in case we have some accidental spills or exposures? We can control there and then. So it's kind of hard, and that all that can generate a lot of information that is very useful to the state and local agencies. Measurements and synthesis. Instrumentation. What type of instrumentation do state agencies need? And if they need, what information are they going to get with those instrumentation? Again, monitoring surveillance during the measurements. IH protocols, do we have some standardized operating procedures? Can we put in place standardized operating procedures based on the science that is available now that state and health practitioners can use to do their activities? Exposure models. If we don't have instrumentation, which of course we don't have up to this moment, that is easy and cheap to access, and then we can come up with exposure models. And what information would states need to come up with those exposure models, just to plug in some numbers or some work practices and get information about the magnitude of the problem on the site? So you can have very easy to model, very easy to use models that state agencies and staff and practitioners can use just when they plug in their numbers, then they can come up with some number that they can base on their decision on. And then risk management, we know that nanomaterials can be very good substitutes to the traditional methods, but we may need training. And this training would be similar to Hazwopa training. For example, the OSHA Hazwopa training, that probably we may need the states to come up with. Some minimum type of components of that training should be described for the contractors that are going to use nanomaterials, so that at least they don't expose the workers to nanoparticles. And of course, we might need some PPEs, we might need engineering controls. At the level of the Superfund sites, which is going to be full scale, probably we might need even something to do with glove boxes, for example, or we might need some ventilation system. Would that be practical in the scenario that we are going to be working with in the Superfund site? Like I said before, emergency response in case of spills, media maybe, like dissemination of information through the media, press, TV, and so on and so forth. That information can be made available at the local level so that at least everyone speaks the same language and we are the same page addressing the issues of exposures in the Superfund site. Waste management and disposal, like I said, once you've used the nanomaterials for environmental remediation, sometimes they become hazards. How do you characterize them? EPA characterized these nanomaterials as hazardous. Okay, should the states do the same? Of course they should. As hazardous until proven that they are not hazardous. And so that information should be available to the states, and we can make that information available to the state as soon as possible before the technology become a little bit commercialized at the large scale. And of course operational experience for the operators in the Superfund size, that may need to be discussed because some states may issue permits and they may need some minimum standards that contractors will have to meet, including operational experience of the workers, the operators, and so on and so forth. Slide number 21. This is some of the slides that I found online when I was doing some research. And some nanomaterials can become a safety issue. Look at the nanoscale zero valent iron, which may ignite spontaneously when it comes into contact with air. You may recall some case of dust explosion in Georgia sugar facility. This could be the same, and if nano zero valent iron is packed in thousands and thousands of tons, probably this could be a safety issue not only to the Superfund site operators, but also to communities in and around the Superfund site. Slide number 22. We may want to generate some information related to the processes that are used for nano-enhanced remediation. Look at the scale, step number one, where you do the injection well, and you have reactive treatment zone created by that. You have number two, injection well, and you have that plume of nano-zero valent iron created, trying to address localized pollutant. And then you have, of course, some nanoparticles to treat surface soil. So in all these three treatment methods described here, how do these physical chemical properties being transformed, and what are the impacts to the groundwater, to the ecosystems themselves? Because in the short term, we may clean up the sites, we may decontaminate the system by accumulative and toxic substances. But what would be the long-term impact of the resulting nanomaterials that are transformed? And as you can see, the groundwater flow is going downstream there, and people maybe 2 or 3 miles may be impacted by that. And so what type of information do we need to have in order to address issues like those? So it's kind of a complex issue. I see it myself, and we probably need to generate information that is useful to the local and state agencies. Slide number 23. This is more to use about the worker himself. The previous slide was more about number 22 was more about the ecological implications. And slide number 23 is more about the worker who is preparing the nanomaterials for remediation. This worker needs to have some protective cloth, for example, protective gears, because there's probably a potential for these materials maybe to become airborne. There's a potential for him to probably be exposed through the skin. And so we now need information on the physical properties to address the issues of preparation before we inject the materials into the ground. So that slide there show you how we may need to address the issue with the preparation before we commercialize the technology. And in this situation, measurements can be recommended. And I'm in touch with the 25 certified that are using the nanomaterials, so that at least we can do some measurements to quantify, because without numbers, probably you might not know the extent of the problem. So if we can quantify whatever materials become airborne, or the skin, potential for skin exposure or demo exposure, then probably we can protect our employees who are working with this nanomaterial in the Superfund site. That's the slurry that it's made, just slurry out of nanomaterials injected into the groundwater for purposes of remediation. And so what type of information, again, do we need in that situation to avoid exposures? Nanoremediation, the role of environmental health and safety professionals. Like I said, there's been a great interest of the scientific community in this area to look at nano-enhanced remediation. A large information has been generated. Case studies have been generated, but it's not so well structured to help with the industrial hygiene work of exposure risk assessment, health risk assessment, or epidemiology for that matter. And so it's not, at the local level, it's kind of difficult to use all that information that's available online. If you go online in databases, a lot of databases, you'll find a lot of information about nanomaterial. But it's not so well structured that can be used at the local level productively. So there's a need to restructure all this information in the framework that I described so that it's useful at the local level. I try to use the nanoinformatics, and it's a national group or national type of approach, 2020 roadmap, on slide number 26, that talks about the information needed will focus mainly on those groups of people around there. And that information, based on the framework that I described, will be based on the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 type of scenarios. The critical thinking, for example, real life examples, in this case, Superfund sites or hazardous waste sites, understanding the work practices of employees, visiting the sites to see actually how employees are handling the materials. And then, of course, have some continuous improvement at the local level through training and so on and so forth. Sharing the information between agencies and agencies so that they can use the resources more effectively in conducting assessment. Across focusing on workers, focusing on health and safety practitioners, focusing on the local level, focusing on policymakers, focusing on liability issues, and so on and so forth. We could also get the information embedded in our curriculum for students, for example, and just to show that this is a technology that's coming. And so what are the issues that we need to look at from the environmental health and safety perspective? And so consumers as well, and emergency responders, police forces, and fire, just in case, like I said, emergency spillages. Slide number 27. What is available at the federal level? Like I said at the beginning of my presentation, very limited information is available at the federal level in terms of standards and regulations. The National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health have recommended, and then these are non-legally binding exposure standards for ultrafine titanium dioxide and fine titanium dioxide. That's just a recommendation. It's not legally binding. We could add the TSCA, Toxic Substances Control Act. This is a federal statute. They consider EMTs as chemical substances. And so anybody who is synthesizing or characterizing these materials need to submit a pre-manufacture notification to EPA. But EPA have only 90 days to review that. All that information that can come up with the materials to review that within a span of 90 days is kind of raises an eyebrow there. And so it's kind of difficult. So EPA has also a significant new role. Appropriate reviews are needed by EPA for any manufacturer. If you're importing or processing, you're subjected to Section 582 of Toxic Substances Control Act. Information gathering, EPA wants all this information, or TSCA, rather, needs all this information in terms of volume, methods of manufacture, processing, and so on and so forth. So that information should be readily available at the fingertips of state agencies if they need to have that information. The test rule, EMTs on the market need to be tested, and that test information needs to be available to EPA and subsequently to probably state agencies. EMTs may be regulated under the Clean Air Act or a federal statute related to environmental, to ambient air quality. And so if they can endanger public, probably, they can be under national ambient air quality standards. But again, these are NPs, nanoparticles, which are minute. They are below 2.5 microns by far away millions and millions of sizes. So is it possible to subject these materials under national ambient air quality standards? Is highly unlikely. So we may need to kind of improve on that national ambient air quality standards to accommodate engineering nanoparticles if they become airborne in the vicinity of urban areas. Slide number 29. Nanomaterials need to be considered as waste in water effluents, discharges, or even air contaminants. But currently we don't have maximum contaminant levels for EMTs. We have maximum contaminant levels for the corresponding bulk materials, but not for EMPs. These state agencies and programs, they regulate maximum contaminant levels that are prescribed by EPA, but would they have the similar type of standards to enforce for EMPs? So it's kind of issue and information that may be needed for the state agencies to have. Discharge of EMPs into the water bodies may require special permits under the Clean Water Act. But do we have information necessary to put the standards in there that this standards apply for EMPs? Slide number 30. Some states may have done something. Some states may need to issue permits to contractors. What information do they need, and how would that information be used to issue the permit? They may need to inspect, audit, and enforce state and health plans for those states which have OSHA state plans. They may have to play a key role on behalf of EPA in some instances for the oversight of the R&D, manufacture, transport, and use of and disposal of EMPs. And so the information that we describe and the framework that I describe, it can be very useful in coming up with that information that can be very supportive of these actions. Some states have done some work, like California and Cambridge and Massachusetts. They have done some work, a little bit, requiring that all inventories of EMPs, manufacturing synthesizing facilities, kind of put up that inventory that can be shared with other stakeholders. They require that information be shared, and updates be available to workers and communities in and across their country, their states. They track research and development activities. They also track some status of regulations and best practices so that at least this is available to the consumers and users. And for the case of Massachusetts, they require changes in regulatory landscape every 2 years. So nanoinformatics and EHS oversight, what are the relevant metrics? We said that nanomaterials change very often, many times their behavior when you start with it, they completely change in the course of reaction, and so they possess all these properties that we cannot monitor and control. We don't have control over them, including aggregation, how do you pronounce that word? To aggregate. They aggregate and then they lose their properties and they can become more toxic or more environmentally damaging. So the sampling techniques in measuring, are they too small to sample or measure with the conventional practices that we have? Do states have the capability to do that, or do they have to hire consultants to do that? And what sense would they make out of the information if the sampling was to be done? Exposure and health risk assessment measurements, we don't have metrics for that, and that metrics is important that we generate that and have it available to the state level. Detection of contamination level as airborne or waterborne, that information is still not available, and some agencies across in the United States that are responsible for developing such protocols include EPA, include NIOSH, and OSHA as well, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. So these agencies could come together for the benefit of protecting the environment, workers, and the health of the general public to come up with standardized protocols that can be passed on to the states. Control of contamination to acceptable levels, like I said, it can be costly to come up with all these standards that we may need. And just to let you know that OSHA itself has been in place for almost 40 years, but they have come up with very few standards that are legally binding. So it can take a long time and process to come up with some standards, acceptable levels. EMTs, how do we control them? Do we have to use glove boxes? Are they efficient? Will they be able to support the function that we need at the pilot level, at the laboratory scale, or even in the field? Would that be feasible to use glove boxes in the field? It's not feasible, so what do we use instead? How do we do administrative control? That is including training, including updating the protocols that we have, and so on and so forth. We have to select PPEs because we need to measure and manage if it's beyond the legally acceptable level. But again, if we don't have the instrumentation that is available to measure, we might not be able to manage through the use of personal protective equipment or PPEs. So all these kind of thinking of what would be the relevant metrics for the states or for the programs across the country to use just to minimize the EHS aspects of negative aspects of nanomaterial, if any. Slide number 33, it talks about nanoinformatics and the same thing, relevant metrics. Metrics to evaluate biological effects. What would those metrics be? Particle size maybe, particle shape, oxidant regeneration, surface functionality, the rate of dissolution. Some literature suggests that all these five parameters can have a negative biological response. All these parameters are useful in making, in fulfilling the objective of remediation in the Superfund site. And all these parameters keep on changing in the course of remediation. So how are we going to use these parameters as information relevant to the states to make their decisions? So again, it's kind of tricky to come up with some parameters that will be effective in regulating nanoparticles. Some other physical parameters, the solubility, pH, and so on and so forth, that may affect some physical conditions of the site, and including groundwater, and so on and so forth. some other parameters like dominating chemistry that may change the dose-response relationship. And so dose-exposure-response relationship can be changed by the dominant chemistry that is governing the remediation. So this is all information that will get into the nanoinformatics project, and then eventually we're going to combine all this information in coming up with some guidance that can be useful at the local level. And basically it's going to be useful for the Superfund sites as well as other applications. It can be very generic to other applications as well. So these are some of the metrics. Risk is hazard if the nanomaterials poses a hazard, environmental health and safety hazards, what is the exposure? So if we can measure that relationship, then we can solve that equation through the use of instrumentation, through the use of models, and eventually we can have that information available to the states so that at least they can support some sustainable use of these materials. And then slide number 35, the flow diagram for a framework to understand nanomaterial has been summarized there. Of course, all that information that is on row number 1 through 4 gives you a risk assessment, and then you can score that. You can compare from site-specific with nanotechnology as well as traditional technology and come up with a score and say whether this risk is acceptable. The site can use that information to decide to go ahead and use nanotechnology or otherwise come up with some risk management plans for the states to be able to approve that if they can minimize the risk that are kind of generated out of that information. So that's slide number 35. So, if I may conclude my presentation, we looked at the nanoinformatics and the framework on generating the information that will be available to the local level. This information will be very helpful to the workers. It can help to protect the safety and health of the workers. It can help a lot to protect the general public, like we saw, that these materials can get into the waterways. So, for me, and as a presenter, I see a very big role for researchers, scientists, manufacturers, vendors, EPA, OSHA, NIOSH, coming together to generate this information. We have seen that at least some 2 states, I call them progressive states, have done something. Some other states may have not have done something, but at least if we start now, we can again protect our employees and general public from exposures like we did for the DDT and PCBs. And so that's all my conclusion, and we need to organize this information so that it becomes relevant and it becomes useful for the states to be able to use that information. So availability and access of and sharing of relevant information will lead to enhanced technical capability of all the states in addressing the issues surrounding ENPs for use in environmental remediation or other applications. So the survey questions that we generated at least 60 questions that went out to the state agencies, and we had to analyze them in detail. But the preliminary assessment of the responses received from agencies and programs across the country indicate that there is urgent need of this information. Because most states have said either they didn't know anything about nanomaterials, they have not had any discussion about nanomaterials, and they didn't know that probably they could pose toxic health effects or ecological impacts or even public health impacts. And so it's urgent and prudent that we generate this information, make it available so that at least states can start making some discussion, can move on to discuss about these issues right now before it's too late. And with that slide, I have slide number 38. That says public health and workers' safety and health can be protected by limiting exposure to environment to engineered nanoparticles. we say they have the potential to create safety hazards, and so we need to at least be more protective of workers in public health. And so precautionary approach can be relevant now, but in the future this information may be needed for regulatory type of legally binding type of regulations and standards that may be put in place, and for the states to have to be able to implement those actions as well. At the federal level, a lot of work has been done, but standards have been limited, and most of those standards are non-legally binding. And some states are kind of having some activities or with nanomaterials in, for the superfine side. Last statement on my slide number 38, there is something that has been set up for Department of Energy that addresses workers who handled atomic weapons during the Cold War. That is called site exposure matrix. If we can come up with site-specific exposure matrices that will help some states to keep track of all this information, it can be very useful in monitoring any health outbreaks. It can be very useful for public health departments to monitor any incidences. If there is disease incidence and so on and so forth, then we can have that information, site-specific information, based on this kind of information that Department of Energy and Department of Labor have put for radiation sites across the country. So we could come up with this database a priori before some sites have implemented the use of nanotechnology, so that we can track the exposure scenarios and be able to kind of associate, have a strong association between exposure and the disease outbreak, and finally eliminate some other kind of factors that are kind of confounding factors. And with that statement, I conclude my presentation today. I want to thank EPA for sponsoring this presentation. I want to thank Jean for being moderator. And I also want to thank Michael Gill of EPA California for being so kind to have this presentation today. Thank you all for listening. Now I invite questions.
From the audience, excellent. Thank you so very much. So with that, for those of you who are listening to the audio online, we do have a number of questions that have been typed up in our electronic queue, and I will turn to those in just a minute. You can continue to click the question mark button at the top of your slides to go ahead and type up any questions or comments you may have. But before I turn to those online questions, I want to give a moment for those of you who are joining us by phone to ask a question or make a comment. So if you're on the telephone line and you have a question for our presenter, please feel free to unmute your line. If you've used our commands, it's #6 to then unmute your phone line, and feel free to either identify yourself or your organization to ask your question.
Hi, Jean and Dr. Massawi. This is Mike Gill. How are you? Thanks for the talk.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask you, Dr. Massawi, nanoremediation is really only one discipline that uses nanomaterials. You've probably seen the interesting website put out by the Wilson Center that shows the use of nanomaterials, and we just checked, and right now there are, it says 1,317 products out there that use nanomaterials. Those are the ones that they either were, they found, or the companies volunteered that information. There probably are even more. My question is, do you have any idea of how much the remediation world uses in actual nanomaterials compared to the rest of industry? Is it a small segment? Is it a 50%? Is it negligible? I'm just not sure where the remediation world falls in that whole scheme of things. Thanks.
Jean, you want me to respond?
Yes, please go right ahead.
Okay. I'm sorry I was disconnected and I had to log in again.
Yeah.
That was the first question, correct?
I can repeat it quickly. The nanomaterials are used in a lot of other industry besides the remedial world. And there are, on one website, the Wilson Center lists 1,317 products. I'm just curious if you have done any research to show what the percentage of nanoparticles for remediation. What's the percentage of use in all products of nanomaterials by our industry, by the remediation industry? Any idea?
No, I haven't done that research to come up with how much is being used right now. Like I said, it's only 35 sites that have been used in this remediation. And this has been really the largest portion of the use of nanomaterials for remediation is in the United States so far. Experimental procedures are going on in the OECD countries. Very minimal work is being done in developing countries. Actually, the United Nations is considering trying to experiment with nanomaterials in developing countries for POPs, persistent organic pollutants. So it's going to be increasing slowly in comparison to the other nanomaterials that have been used for other consumer products. But I don't have a number to say this is a fraction that is being used with remediation in comparison to other other consumer products.
Okay, great. Mike, did you have a follow-on question?
No, thank you, Dr. Misali.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you. Anybody else on the phone lines? Again, it's #6 to unmute and let us know either your name or your organization. Okay. Well, I'm going to go ahead and start in with some of the questions that have been submitted electronically. We're going to start with the first one. And they're asking, where did you get the data for the table on slide number 11?
This data was obtained from various sources, including, I think, EPA. That's not my information. That's from research. I could get the source for those who are interested. I could get the source of that information.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Then I would refer everyone. We'll talk about how to contact you afterwards when we're done with today's session. So if you are interested to follow up with Dr. Misali, I'll provide information on how to reach out to him when we formally conclude today. The next question, though, is coming in. This is another online question. They ask, where can I get a copy of the Nano, I think, Information 2020 Roadmap?
Again, I should be, I think on the slide number 26, I say 2020, Nanoinformatics 2020 Roadmap. That information will be available. If you Google in Nanoinformatics 2020 Roadmap, it should be available. Otherwise, I will be able to also send that slide, link to that slide as well.
Or a
slide to Nanoinformatics Roadmap.
Okay. The next, I have a couple of questions that have come in from various places in the U.S., and I think they're all sort of asking the same general question. So I'm going to read three of them together, and then I think you can address them all in one answer. But
sure.
The first question asks, are they taking the same regulatory approach to managing EMPs in Europe? And then the next question asks, are any states working on regulatory levels for EMPs? Does any organization have a level set, for example, in the United States or in the UK? And then the next question related to that is that, you know, where can we find out about the states that are, quote, doing something about EMPs? So looking for the specifics on who actually has a number in place.
Yeah, the two states that have done a lot of work, like I said, is Massachusetts and probably California. They have different distinct approaches, actually. In California, they are under the Department of Toxic Substances Control Act. They have this call-in information, and manufacturers, vendors, they provide that information through a call-in system that the Department of Toxic Substances Control have put aside. And in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that initiative of requiring data to be available should be available with the state agencies in Massachusetts, and I can have that also sent out to participants. But with the question of Europe having started at the local level, I'm not quite sure if the information that is available has been, or even if the European countries are kind of organized in the same way, whereby you have this kind of federal type of a system where states have kind of their mandate to implement at the local level. I'm not sure if that system was in there. But what I know is OECD has done some work, covering a lot of work, for the European countries, which I'm not sure if it spills down to the local level for implementation. But again, all boils down into one thing, availability of the information in a coherent way that it can be used for decision making in a particular application, in this case, remediation, and to address, let's say, airborne particulates, which most countries have not done, have not come up with the standards. So they don't have the standards yet, airborne kind of standards that are legally binding, other than the NIOSH recommended limits, which are non-legally binding. And so not much has been done in that aspect.
Okay, great. Our next question, there were a couple of individuals who were asking questions specifically about applying nanomaterials for remediation, which I think goes beyond the scope of what this presentation was focusing on, because they're looking for specifics on when you would use nanomaterials to clean up sites, how would you handle hydraulic conductivity issues. So I think those more specific technology application questions go beyond the scope for today, and I'll be able to refer to those of you who have technology or application-specific questions about actually using nanomaterials for cleaning up sites to all the resources and seminars that we've hosted in the past. So I just wanted to be sure those of you who have submitted the technology-focused questions, we have them in the queue, and I'll touch base with you guys with other information sources for those particular ones. I do, though, have a couple of other questions that have come in online. And the next one is actually coming in from the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, and their question is this. Since in many cases there do not appear to be any state or federal standards specifically for nanomaterials, what specific standards do the nanomaterials currently fall under? And I think you've kind of started to address that. Are they currently covered by default by the standards that apply to the non-nano version of these chemicals, regardless of whether the standard makes sense from a public or health technical perspective?
Yeah, that's a very nice question. Like I said in my presentation, at the level of nanoscale, these materials are kind of possess these properties that are kind of very peculiar from the bulk materials. Even the material safety data sheets themselves, in some situations, manufacturer or synthesizers, I would call them, they just send the materials with the conventional material safety data sheets, unfortunately. But their properties are very distinctly different from the bulk materials. And so for that reason, it's kind of hard to say you're going to depend on the properties or the standards or the guidance given by the material safety data sheets to make decisions. So from that perspective, I think states, including Pennsylvania Environmental Protection, probably should use like precautionary type of approach in addressing the issues of nanomaterials.
Okay, great. Thank you. This next question is coming in from Briarcliff Manor in New York State, and they ask, you mentioned the NIOSH RELs for titanium dioxide nanoparticles.
Yeah.
NIOSH has published an interim protocol for industrial hygienists for sampling for nanoparticles based on mass concentration using filters and personal sampling pumps. However, depending on the results, analysis by transmission electron microscopy is required. But NIOSH has not provided any guidance on using the TEM, or transmission electron microscopy, to convert the number count of particles to mass concentration. Have you encountered this situation? And if so, how is the TEM used to obtain a mass concentration to get results to compare to the NIOSH RELs for titanium dioxide particles?
Actually, I haven't been able to get into the field yet. That is one of the requests that I'm asking any participant who is having a field exercise or is implementing these nanomaterials remediation technology to kind of invite us, myself, EPA, into the site so that we can come and kind of document exposure scenarios. And so I don't have data from the field that I have generated myself. I'm still struggling, and I'm supposed to be out in at least 5 sites every year for the next 3 years. And I would appreciate if I could get an opportunity from the participants on this call to invite me and the university and EPA, for example, to come to the site and to generate that information.
Okay, great. And we'll certainly, before we close things out, I'll make sure we have a way to relay information and questions back and forth with your contact information. I want to double check and see if anybody else on the telephone lines has any follow-on or last questions before we close things out. Again, if you're on the telephones, it's #6 to unmute, and then feel free to identify yourself or your organization. Okay. And again, just a reminder to those of you that submitted electronic questions that were regarding the actual technology application of using nanomaterials or selecting nanoparticles as a remediation approach to clean up a hazardous waste site, I will be able to refer you to other resources that may be able to help answer those questions, including previously hosted CLUIN seminars. Those types of questions are a little bit beyond the scope of today's presentation. So it doesn't sound like we have any other questions either on the phone lines or being submitted electronically. So I'm going to ask everyone to move along to slide number 40 so that we can begin the closeout procedures for today's event. So on slide number 40, you'll find two important links. The first one is a link to the resources page. If you're not at a computer with internet access, you just have a printout copy in front of you. These hyperlinks are available on the seminar homepage, so you can certainly come back and access these URLs at any time, and they'll continue to remain active indefinitely following today's session. But on the additional resources page, you'll be able to download a copy of today's presentation, as well as check out a few other resources related to the seminar today. The other link that you'll find on slide number 40 is a link to our short feedback form. Please note that I do read each and every one of the submissions that are put through on the feedback forms, and it only takes about a minute or two to fill it out. We really do rely heavily upon your comments and your suggestions on future deliveries and ways to improve the seminars that we're able to host through CLUIN. So I would ask if you could take just a minute and let us know what you thought of today's session. If you are looking for credit of your participation today, we don't offer CEUs or PDHs through CLUIN. However, many of our participants are able to earn credit from their accrediting institution if they keep a copy of their registration email, they download and save a copy of the slides that were covered, and then they fill out the feedback form. Because when you fill out the feedback form, you can actually check a box and have a confirmation message sent to you for your own record keeping that does at least verify that you gave us feedback for today's event when we concluded this seminar. If you shared the line with multiple individuals, once you submit the feedback form, the next person can actually hop on and there'll be a link they can click on and fill out their own feedback form and get their own confirmation email for their own records. With that, I'm going to ask everybody to go ahead and move along to slide number 41. And I want to remind you, if you haven't noticed it yet, we're trying to do as much as we can to connect with our audience and share information as well as engage in dialogue with people who are involved in the hazardous waste cleanup professional community. So a few months ago, we actually unleashed a new Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn pages or groups that you can join. So if you don't get TechDirect, our monthly newsletter that goes out, I would encourage you to go to CLUIN and check it out. If you go to any page on CLUIN.org, you'll see links to stay connected through one of these new social and professional media outlets. So if you'd like to get the latest information as soon as new seminars like this one are made available, or you want to check out new resources as soon as we find them, please try to connect with us through one of these outlets. I want to continue to express my gratitude for those out in EPA Region 9 that helped bring the seminar to CLUIN. I also want to extend my thanks to Dr. Massawi, who took time on a very busy travel schedule to manage to fit it in to deliver this talk actually a number of times, including one of these talks here via CLUIN. We really do appreciate everyone who worked so hard to pull together today's session, as well as the over 100 individuals who joined us from all across the United States. I hope that you found today to be a valuable expenditure of your time. Remember, you will automatically receive an email from me as soon as that recording is made available for free download and replay. For those of you that have follow-up questions for Dr. Massawi, or perhaps may have information related to his request, and again, I believe he's looking for sites that he can actually go out and join or be a part of the field activities related to nanoparticles, his contact information is available on the seminar homepage. You'll find his complete bio as well as his email address there. So if you go back to the same page that you referred to when you signed up today, you'll be able to find his information. You can also certainly contact me. I'm balance.jean@epa.gov, and I'll be happy to pass your question or information on to Dr. Massawi. So with that, again, I want to thank everybody who took time out of their busy day to join us today. I want to again thank Dr. Massawi and EPA Region 9 who helped bring this seminar to CLUIN. And I hope that you all have a great rest of your day wherever you're located. This is the formal conclusion for today's seminar. Thank you.